May well regulate a militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Hopefully you had a good weekend and are getting ready for a good Thanksgiving. This is the first year that I will be cooking at least some of Thanksgiving dinner. And I got to tell you, I'm a little concerned, but I'll give you an honest after-action report a week from today, and I'll let you know how it goes. On the program today, we've got Virginia Citizens Defense League President Philip Van Cleve joining us. We're going to be talking about what is going on in Virginia regarding gun control. And right now, it's a case of the dog that isn't barking. Unlike 6 years ago, when Democrats took complete control of state government and they made gun control front and center, their biggest legislative priorities, they're not really talking about it this year. There have been a couple of bills that have been introduced, but nothing along the lines of a magazine ban, a ban on so-called assault weapons, waiting periods, expansion of red flag law, an end to firearms preemption, pistol purchase permits. We know those are coming, but they have not introduced these bills yet. And as we get into it with Phil, I think that Democrats are smart. I think they learned a lesson from 6 years ago. They don't want to see the Second Amendment sanctuary movement revitalized across the Commonwealth. 6 years ago, at this time, I had already gone out. In fact, I wrote about this last week. I think it was November 20th. I went to my first county supervisors meeting when the Second Amendment sanctuary movement was taking place. It was in Amelia County, which is about a 45-minute drive from where I live. Now, that night, there was not even a resolution. There wasn't a Second Amendment sanctuary resolution on the agenda. But it was the first county supervisors meeting that had been held in Amelia County since the election, since we had learned about the Democrats' gun ban plans. And it was packed. I mean, it wasn't just even packed. There were hundreds of people outside of the county supervisors meeting because they could not get inside. I had never seen anything like that. Philip Van Cleve was actually there that night. I heard him speak on the steps of the courthouse. We are not seeing anything like that right now. And in large part, I think that is because Democrats are keeping a very tight, they keep their lips zipped when it comes to talking about gun control. We're getting a stray comment here or there. But again, they are very, very studiously staying away from talking about gun control publicly, even as they craft their plans behind closed doors. Now, before we get to our conversation with Philip Van Cleve, I also want to mention Supreme Court orders came down mid-morning on Monday. They denied cert to one case. They apparently held on to a couple of others. So we were talking about this last week. The challenge to the gun ban for illegal aliens. This was a Carbajal Flores versus U.S. The Supreme Court denied cert in that case, so they will not be hearing the appeal of Eberito Carbajal Flores, who was had alleged that yes, he was in this country illegally at the time. Apparently, he's a lawful resident now, but he was in this country illegally back in 2020 when he was caught possessing a firearm in Chicago. District court said, there's no evidence that this guy's dangerous. He's never been convicted of a violent crime, never been convicted of any other crime for that matter. And yes, he does fall under the people who are protected by the Second Amendment. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals rejected that argument. They said, no. This statute is perfectly fine, comports with the Second Amendment. And Carbajal Flores can be charged with possessing a firearm as an illegal alien. Supreme Court, again, essentially upholding that Seventh Circuit decision by denying Carbajal Flores' appeal. The Supreme Court did not take any action in two other cases dealing with prohibited persons, Vincent versus Bondi and Duarte versus United States. Both of those are essentially challenging the lifetime prohibition on firearms for people convicted of a crime that can be punished by more than a year in prison. But more specifically, in both of their cases, nonviolent crimes. We've talked about Melinda Vincent's case. I guess we're talking about Stephen Duarte's case, too. But Melinda Vincent, convicted of writing a bad check 17 years ago, sentenced to probation. She has turned her life around since then. She's a drug and alcohol counselor who works for the state of Utah. She's got her own private practice. Stephen Duarte had a few more run-ins with the law, and there were more recent run-ins with the law, but still nonviolent offenses. Supreme Court, again, taking no action on those cases. So they could relist them. They could just add Vincent and Duarte to the cases that are already sort of sitting in limbo, cases that have been considered but are not appearing apparently in conference right now. Supreme Court is taking no action on these cases. We've got the under 21 gun bans, four of those cases that the Supreme Court is just kind of holding on to. Got a couple of other prohibited persons cases. So we'll know later today if any or all of those cases get relisted for a future conference. Obviously, the Supreme Court not holding conference this week because Thanksgiving, but they'll pick it up again next week. And there are some other Second Amendment cases that are slated for conference next week as well. We'll talk about that later on in the week. Right now, let's get to, let's get to our conversation with VCDL President Philip Van Cleave, talking about the threat over the horizon to Virginians' gun rights. Take a look and a listen. Philip, thank you so much for joining me on the program. It's good to see you again.
Hey, Cam. It's always good to see you.
I wish the topic were better, honestly, but
I agree.
I mean, you know, the Virginia elections were just an absolute debacle for gun owners, and I have a feeling our nightmare is just beginning. So I want to ask you, you know, 6 years ago when Democrats took control of state government, one of the very first things that they did, then Governor Ralph Northam said, we're doing a semi-auto ban. Right. Very, very much a priority for the Democrats, which led to the Second Amendment sanctuary movement just sweeping across the state. 6 years ago, this time next year, you know, this time 6 years ago, we had already had, I think, well over two dozen communities that had adopted Second Amendment sanctuary resolutions. I think the Democrats learned from that because they're playing their cards very close to the vest when it comes to their gun control agenda for 2026. Do you agree?
I completely agree. Yeah, it's not like it was back then. In fact, they haven't said a whole lot about the agenda recently. Back then, you had Northam out there spouting, well, you know, we're not even sure if we're not going to confiscate guns.
Right.
And boy, that woke people up. People that should have been awake anyhow, but it woke up the sleeping people that normally don't get involved in anything. And that caused the thing to sweep. But yeah, this time around, they're being very quiet. We were sort of expecting that the HB1 and SB1, the first bills out, would be an assault weapon ban, but they weren't. As of Friday, there were two bills introduced so far. Now, a bunch of them are going to come in, and we're going to see a bunch of gun control. But you're right, they're not laying their hand out quickly. They're keeping those cards close to the vest.
And I think that is very much by design. I don't think they want to see a resurgence of the Second Amendment sanctuary movement. And I think as soon as a gun ban bill drops, we are going to see that movement. I think reinvigorated across the state of Virginia. At least I hope we will.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope so too. If you look at everything they tried to do over the last 2 years, we've kind of accumulated that list. That's a lot of really bad stuff. Now, at the time, they were pretty certain that the governor would veto it. So that may have made them a little more tendency to do virtue signaling with bills they knew wouldn't go anywhere. Now that they can go somewhere, it'll be interesting to see what they do now. I know that the gun control crowd seems to be feeling their oats about this time, what I've read. But that doesn't necessarily, we'll just have to see how that all plays out.
Yeah, well, I mean, we know that they're working on at least one, you know, bill to ban so-called assault weapons. There's been a report I saw, Senator Cray Deeds, who 6 years ago objected to a gun ban. Now he's authored a ban on so-called assault weapons in the legislature. He says that they've been having meetings about that topic. Scott Surville, a state senator who's on the Virginia Crime Commission, made some comments last week about a permit to purchase. A law similar to a Maryland's handgun qualification law. There was some discussion about maybe the parameters of that because that would come with a fiscal note. It would cost, probably. I think he said Delaware's new permit to purchase law is estimated to cost about $7.5 million. But Virginia has about eight times the population of Delaware, so you can extrapolate $50 million a year to run a permit to purchase scheme. The backup plan seems to be requiring some sort of firearms training before you can purchase a firearm, although not necessarily a formal permit to purchase. But, I mean, just these hints that we're getting here, Phil, as you say, the gun control advocates are feeling their oats, and it sounds like there are, it sounds like the Democrats are at least willing to entertain the possibility of you know, going all out here this session.
Yeah, yeah. It's just that they're not, they're, it's like they may load that up at the end of the, towards the end of the bills being coming in, then all of a sudden, boom, you know, here's a whole bunch of these. Hopefully, from their point of view, they would be thinking, well, you know, maybe after Lobby Day, we'll let all these bills drop, or so close to it that the, that a lot of people that weren't going to go still won't have it, or were going to go might change, might think nothing's going to happen and not show up and so forth. It's hard to say.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the timing of that. When is Lobby Day next year?
It's the January 19th. It's the third. It's always the third Monday, MLK Day. Yep, and we, 11 o'clock is the rally. We start at 8 a.m. Lobbying.
And when is the deadline to introduce legislation for the 2026 session? Do you know?
It's usually, then I'm not sure off the top of my head. It's usually just a few days after that. It's sort of, it seems okay. Like this is a short session this year, so it's going to go pretty quick.
Okay. But if they wanted to, it sounds like, as you say, they could hold all of these gun bills until mid January and then drop them all either right before Lobby Day or right after Lobby Day, which, you know, again, it would be a tactically sound decision on their part. I hate to say it. But as long as, you know, it drives me crazy, Phil, because, you know, when gun control becomes a front and center issue, Virginians will wake up. But the challenge right now is for organizations like yourself, for people like me, to get the word out, to tell Virginia gun owners, don't be asleep at the switch. Now's the time to get engaged. We've got to be proactive here. We know what's coming, even if the Democrats haven't tipped their hand completely yet.
Yeah, even if you don't see the bills yet, don't assume they're not coming and therefore not prepare for them. That seems to be the biggest problem. People react the strongest when they actually see the threat. The fact that it's just over the horizon coming is not as exciting to them or more as invigorating as actually seeing what's coming. So, yeah, we're just going to see. I'll be checking every day. I go through all the bills that come in, so I don't, hopefully not missing something that might not appear to be a gun bill, but is.
Yeah, because they're going to get pretty stealthy. And as you say, the two bills that have dropped, the first one was basically a bill to make it easier to sue gun makers, gun sellers for the actions of criminals, right, to try to get around the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act.
Right, but stronger than that, if you sell even accessories, let's say you're not even an FFL, you don't sell guns, but you sell holsters and you sell other things, they can come after you too. If that holster ends up in a criminal action, they can say, well, you should have known you were selling that to a criminal. Of course, we all shake our heads and go, this is totally asinine, but welcome to the world of gun control.
Right, yeah.
They don't
care
that it sounds asinine. It's just...
No, because I mean, again, you know, most folks aren't going to read the fine print. But as you say, this bill says if you don't follow reasonable controls, which are not defined, by the way,
of course not.
But apparently, reasonable controls go beyond federal and state law, right? And as you say, if you don't exercise those reasonable controls, and a accessory or a firearm is used in a crime, then that presents a cause of action to sue the retailer. The second bill. On the surface, at first I thought, Phil, this bill was kind of neutral, right? So if you lose the ability to legally possess a firearm, this bill would allow you to transfer firearm to somebody over the age of 21. They could keep possession of those firearms. But buried in there, there's a registry. You got to report that to the state. You got to report that transfer. So this sets up at least a partial gun registry. And it also sets the age to receive those firearms at 21 as opposed to 18, which is when our Second Amendment rights kick in. So even there, as you say, this, you know, you're just a quick surface glance at this. It might not seem that bad, but it still advances the anti-gunners ideology.
Yeah, they want to disarm young adults. And this is just, you'll see more of that. We'll see more of them trying this. What if a husband and wife have one gun that they share for self-defense between them, and the husband gets a restraining order or whatever? Now that gun has to leave the house, which means the wife couldn't keep a gun for her own safety. She's done nothing wrong, and if she locked it away from him, which you can do if your spouse is a felon, you can still own guns, but you have to make damn sure they don't have access. safes that have locks that they don't have the combination to, or the gun is on you physically where they don't have access to it. But they're trying to even knock that out. It's just a bite at a time. And it's kind of like when you pay your bills, you know, you buy something for $10 here and $10 there. Next thing you know, you're at $500, and they're doing the same thing with gun laws.
Yeah, absolutely. And
we look back and go, holy cow, did we lose a lot of stuff?
And these are just the appetizers, the two bills that we've seen introduced right now. I mean, I don't know about you, but as you say, you've been following this stuff the last couple of years. And Governor Youngkin has vetoed dozens of gun control measures over the past few
60,
years.
60 total. And some were duplicates, but.
Yeah. What is your advice right now to gun owners in Virginia? And what response are you seeing from VCDL members right now? You know, we talked about Democrats playing, you know, keep away from the news cycle. Are VCDL members paying attention? Are they engaged? Are they already reaching out to their county supervisors, the county sheriffs, their local Commonwealth attorneys?
Some of them are. We've certainly seen a bump in membership. People, my membership expired 5 years ago. I want to reinstate it. But we see seeing that donations and stuff to help with the legal battles that we've got coming. We held a meeting in Northern Virginia, and almost everybody in the room said that they were going to come to lobby day. So we're expecting a larger lobby day. I don't know if we'll have one as big as we did in 2020, but we are expecting a larger lobby day than we've had for the last 4 years or so.
I expect Democrats are going to do everything they can to make sure we don't have another lobby day like we had in 2020 when tens of thousands of people were there in downtown Richmond just packing the streets around the Capitol. I don't think they want those optics. So I think they're going to do everything they can to try to delay, again, the introduction of these really bad bills that are coming. But again, we know they're coming. They, like you said, yeah, they might be over the horizon. And we know that they're on the way, so we need to be in Richmond January 19th. Folks, you guys do a great job, by the way, of letting folks know how they can get there. You've got buses coming from around the state, generally speaking, right? So mm-hmm. if folks live in Southwest Virginia, they live up in Northern Virginia, they don't want to just carpool down or drive by themselves, hop on a bus with other Second Amendment patriots and get down there. But I got to tell you, this is a crucially important lobby day. Democrats, you know, they took 13, they got 13 more seats in the House of Delegates.
I know. I was not expecting that big. I've kind of written this off as Trump derangement syndrome was what really drove this, because we saw that's exactly what happened in 2019.
Yeah.
Trump got elected and Northern Virginia threw a fit, and they took control away from the Republicans and handed it over to Democrats. And that started the mess up there. So I think this is just, again, it's the same thing. Trump won. When he did, I was kind of going, okay, I wonder how this is going to shake out. And sure enough, I think that's a lot to do with how we are where we are. And if the Democrats misbehave, keep in mind, in 2 years, the House and the Senate are both up for grabs.
Yep.
So if they really misbehave badly, and maybe this will help keep them a little under control, they could lose power again, just like they did, back in the election following all the stuff that they did.
Well, they've clearly learned some lessons from 2019. So maybe they will learn some lessons from, 2021 as well. So the House has the supermajority. They've got some wiggle room. They can lose some Democrats on some of these gun bills. The Senate, though, is a different story, right? Senate 21-19 in favor of the Democrats. So, I mean, if you're looking at this just from a legislative standpoint, if there are going to be opportunities to defeat some of these bills, it seems like it's going to be on the Senate side of things. And it's probably going to be, because you mentioned the Senate's up for grabs 2 years from now. We're probably looking at, swing district senators, maybe some rural Democrats. But I'm going to ask you, Phil. I mean, I have no expectation that we're going to be able to defeat every bad bill that's
highly unlikely. But we need to get two Democrats to vote against, not one, because they've got Ghazala Hashmi as the new lieutenant governor. She breaks ties, and I can tell you right now, there's no doubt in my mind how she'll break a tie. She was my senator for four miserable years, so I'm familiar with her. And boy, she dodged me like mad. I never had a personal meeting with her. She's just not very brave. She didn't want to debate either when she was running. So, you know, but she enjoys power. So, yeah, so we've got to get two to go our way.
Yeah.
But again, as you point out, that lobby day, a lot of people were saying back, oh, well, I don't know if this did anything. Oh, yes, it did. Oh, big time. Mm-hmm. The fact that some people can't see it isn't our fault. They're not opening their eyes and didn't really watch what happened. But not only did it kill the assault weapon ban, I mean, I don't know if you remember, that bill was brought up in a committee it wasn't even supposed to be in front of, and they immediately kill it. Like, that was the first order of business the day after that rally was kill the assault weapon ban. Boom, gone. I mean, it was, I never saw a bill disappear so fast. So that, oh yeah, it had an effect. And then everything got toned down after that. They wanted a lot stronger things, and they toned them down. So yeah, we got gun control, but we didn't get it on the level they were hoping for. We got something much more diluted. So, you know, we have to make sure we do the same thing. Keep it so they don't want those optics. And how do they avoid the optics? Well, the best way for them to do it is not put in bad, these horrible gun control bills.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right. The lobby day made a difference. I mean, we did see, it was 5 gun control measures passed that year. But as you say, a lot of those were watered down. Instead of completely ending preemption, which was the idea, they weakened preemption. They put in place a universal background check law that, thanks to, I believe VCDL has helped to secure an injunction against enforcement of that.
Yes.
You know, which again speaks to the ability to go out and challenge whatever does pass in court going forward. But absolutely, that lobby day made a huge impact. I mean, it did put a couple of those rural Democrat senators on notice that if you vote for this stuff, your seats are in jeopardy. And mm-hmm. I hope that we have that same grassroots response this year, or excuse me, in early January, because the threat is just as real, if not more so, as it was 6 years ago. So, folks, you know, how can folks find out more information about the lobby day? Do you have information already up at vcdl.org?
Yeah, we do. We're continuing to flesh out the new website. We have a brand new website we went over, but we've got vcdl.org/lobbyday, one word, lobby day. And that will give you information on buses and all kinds of stuff. And that'll be updated as we get closer and closer to January 19th. There'll be a pre-lobby day dinner that Sunday. January 19th is always on a Monday, and the Sunday before, we usually have a pre-lobby day dinner for people that have either live in the Central Virginia area and want to have a little camaraderie before the thing, or people who have driven down, spent the night in hotels. We had a lot of that. And they can, that way they've got a way to have dinner with a bunch of like-minded individuals. Everybody always has fun at those. And the rally. I mean, that 2020 rally was, anybody that missed that, boy, did they miss an event. That was really something to be at. It really was.
It truly was. I will never forget standing there at that podium, just looking out on that sea of Second Amendment supporters. It truly was. I mean, it goosebumps, and not just because it was freezing cold that right. day. It really was a goosebump moment. And I hope that we can replicate that, or at least come close to it next January, just a few weeks from now. Philip Van Cleve, we're going to be talking between now and then, because I suspect that we are going to get at least a trickle of information about what's coming our way. And I'd love to have you back. But thank you for everything you're doing. Thanks for joining me on the program today. And again, I'd encourage folks, just check out vcdl.org and make plans to attend the Lobby Day rally in Richmond on January 19th.
Thank you, Cam, for getting the word out. You're a big voice out there. We need that.
Well, anything I can do to help, Phil. Thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thanks.
My thanks to Phil for joining us on the program. And yeah, we'll be talking again here in a couple of weeks, but certainly before January 19th. Before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, I do want to mention the Gundy's Awards. The nominations are out. Voting starts December the 1st, and I am honored to be one of the nominees for Podcast of the Year. Now, this award is determined by votes. So you'll have an opportunity to start voting December 1st. That closes December 15th. I'm going to do my best to remind you all, but I'm terrible at self-promotion, which is why I forgot to let you even know that I was nominated until just now. But I want to thank the folks at the Gundy's for nominating Cam and Company as Podcast of the Year. And I will try not to bug y'all, but I will also try to remind you that you can vote when voting opens up on December the 1st. All right. Let's get to, again, to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We're going to start there with a case we talked about kind of obliquely at Bearing Arms last week, the case of this New York City man who acted in self-defense but was charged with illegally possessing the firearm that he used when he acted in self-defense, as well as several dozen other firearms that he had in his home that were unregistered. This 67-year-old man, Charles Foner, sentenced to 4 years in prison for illegal gun possession, which is considered a violent felony in New York City, even though the only reason that police determined and discovered that he possessed these firearms illegally is because he used one of those firearms to lawfully protect himself against an assailant. The New York Post editorial board has a piece out on this. New York City's perverted justice jailing a senior citizen while rapists go free. So they not only object to the 4-year sentence that Charles Foner received, although they do say there's little excuse for having an arsenal of illegal guns and Foner should undoubtedly face some punishment. But they add, why any prison for a senior citizen with no priors? Sure, confiscate his weapons, fine him, put him on probation, and warn that reoffending will mean hard time. But they say he's almost certainly not an ongoing danger to himself or others, unlike all too many violent repeat offenders who get cut loose with zero prison or even jail time again and again. They write, look at the monster who was let go on the condition that he undergo mental health treatment after he lured a 14-year-old to his apartment and raped her in 2013, only to pull the same sick stunt with a 15-year-old this year. Or the sicko, they write, who just got 10 years probation and an order to attend a sex offender treatment program for raping a woman that he met on Tinder. Or the menace with a history of random attacks who was cut loose on supervised release after he stabbed a stranger on a Bronx train in September, only to slash another man in the face the very next month. Or the cabbie who Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg declined to prosecute after he was accused of groping two women in the back of his car. The editorial board wonders, how did all of these true threats to society get lighter punishments than a guy who had illegal guns in his house for decades and seemingly only used one once for his own protection? They then note that the guy who Foner shot was himself a repeat offender who would likely be alive today if the system had done its job and either jailed him or forced him into treatment for his mental illness. They note that other blue cities suffer the same pro-crime lunacy. Talking about another case we've referenced here on Bearing Arms, the woman in Chicago who was set on fire by a guy who, allegedly by an individual who had dozens of prior arrests, I think 71, the New York Post says, prompting even lefty Mayor Johnson, they write, to call it an absolute failure of our criminal justice and mental health institutions. Now, again, I'm going to take issue with the New York Post saying that Foner deserved a punishment for having this arsenal of illegal weapons in his home, because I don't believe that our right to keep and bear arms should come with a permission slip from the state. And in New York City, in order to become a legal gun owner, even to keep a gun in your home, you have got to run a gauntlet of bureaucratic hurdles that are designed to keep you away from exercising your Second Amendment rights. New York City is the poster child for why gun permitting laws should be seen as unconstitutional. When it costs hundreds of dollars, when it takes up to a year or more of your time to be told by the government, okay, you get to exercise this fundamental civil right, we're not treating that as a fundamental civil right. Anyway, that's a bit of a tangent, but the New York Post is absolutely correct in noting the fact that violent offenders in New York City are routinely walking with lighter sentences than what Mr. Foner received for possessing firearms in his home without a permit. Dexter Taylor, same thing. He made his own guns and possessed them without a permit. 10 years for that crime, for that violent felony offense. And Dexter Taylor sitting in a maximum security prison in New York for the crime, quote unquote, of exercising his Second Amendment rights without permission from the city of New York. On to today's armed citizen story. From Eugene, Oregon, where the local district attorney says a shooting at a Walmart was self-defense. And yeah, it sounds like it was. It was back on September the 5th, just before 5:30 in the afternoon. A man named Elijah Leyes shot and killed a 21-year-old named Javier Legarda Govilla in the parking lot of a Walmart supercenter. The DA says that Legarda Govia was reaching for a loaded handgun tucked into his waistband when he pursued Leyes and his stepson as they ran to their truck in the parking lot. Leyes was able to get his gun from his truck and shot his attacker before his attacker could shoot him. That's the conclusion of Lane County DA Christopher Perosa. That investigation and review involved surveillance, cell phone videos, witness accounts, which Perosa said confirmed Leyes and his stepson's recollection of what happened that day. A couple of days before this happened, back on September the 2nd, Leyes and his stepson's attorney were at the Lane County Courthouse for a court date. They're standing outside the courthouse. Two guys approach in a black SUV. One of them gets out and verbally accosts them, stating something along the lines of, "I'm going to blow your head off." Don't know what the previous relationship was between Leyes' stepson and these two individuals. But anyway, the day of the shooting, Leyes and his stepson were inside that Walmart. They again encounter the three men. They start cussing at him, calling him racial slurs, according to the prosecutor. Prosecutor said that as Leyes and his stepson were leaving the store, Leyes realized that the three men were following him and then told the stepson, "Run ahead to the truck. Go to the truck." Stepson confirmed to investigators that he ran to the truck, locked himself inside. Legarda Govia began to run after the stepson, but Leyes then pushed him to the ground. Leyes then ran to the driver's side of his truck, noticed Legarda Govia get up, reach for his waistband, and actually pull out a firearm. That's when Leyes grabbed his own gun from the driver's side door, shot Legarda Govia. After he was shot, Legarda Govia's firearm fell out of his hands onto the ground. Leyes then kicked it away. Leyes called 911, remained on scene, described as cooperative with police throughout the investigation. The two other men who accompanied Legarda Govia fled the scene but were later identified. Police found another gun belonging to one of the individuals in a field near the Walmart after the shooting. So, again, I don't know why it took a couple of months to make this determination. I guess maybe they had to talk with witnesses, had to make sure that review was complete. But, again, based on the circumstances described by the prosecuting attorney here in Eugene, Oregon, yeah, this was a clear-cut case of self-defense. You've got somebody who's already threatened to kill you, somebody who chases after you, somebody who pulls a gun. You have a reasonable belief that your life is in danger under those circumstances, right? So I would say, you know, we'll look for new follow-ups, and I don't think we're going to get any follow-ups here. I think that is the end of that case, at least as far as the justice system is concerned there in Eugene, Oregon. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, when able to do the right thing. A couple in Arizona, and I love the stories like this, just little things. I mean, this isn't even, you know, rescuing somebody from a burning car or pulling them out of a car that's gone into a lake. We've got plenty of those stories over the past couple of months, people rescuing strangers or neighbors from burning homes. This is just doing something nice. That's all it is. Couple, both cancer survivors, spread joy to doctors who save their lives with free ice cream. It wasn't just the doctors who saved their lives, by the way, but it was basically every employee who wanted some ice cream who could get to the stand there at the MD Anderson Cancer Center. And again, this was last week, and it was the result of, just a couple wanted to do something nice, wanted to pay it back. Evan Scarbeck and his wife Holly are both cancer survivors. They own Stella's Ice Cream in Gilbert, Arizona. And last Thursday, they took their business on the road to the MD Anderson Cancer Center. Scarbeck said, "I like putting smiles on faces." Said it's a perfect business where people come in. They can be in a good mood, bad mood, neutral, but they're going to walk out with a smile on their face. Scarbeck, a Navy veteran, is currently in remission from testicular cancer. He hopes to be declared fully cured within the next couple of years. Underwent chemotherapy, underwent radiation. And as he was going through all of that, he said ice cream was kind of a lifesaver. His oncologist said, we'll often have folks eat foods that aren't traditionally healthy. Ice cream is one way to do it. Saying that the high caloric content helped Scarbeck maintain his weight during treatment, which gave him the strength to fight the disease. And after he was in remission, Scarbeck and his wife decided to open up their ice cream shop as just, they just, again, a way to sort of give back to the community. They also recently learned that they are expecting their first child, which is kind of miraculous. Doctors have told Scarbeck that he would not be likely to start a family after his cancer treatment. He said, "I couldn't be more thrilled. He said, I didn't know this was going to be in the deck of cards, so I honestly could not be happier. They say that they plan to do this again in the future. But again, last Thursday, showing up there at the Banner MD Anderson Cancer Center in Arizona with some free scoops for employees, putting a smile on their face, giving back. And again, thank you, Evan and Holly, for your very, very good deed. And congratulations on your little bundle of joy that is heading your way. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for joining me on the program today. Looking to see you back here again tomorrow. But be sure to check out BearingArms.com. In the meantime, we're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. If you like what you see, I'd also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off of your VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum membership. You get great benefits no matter what tier of support you choose. I am partial to the VIP Gold and Platinum because then you get to take part in our weekly live chats every Wednesday afternoon, 1:30 p.m. Hot Airs at Morrissey and myself would love for you to be a part of that. But again, no matter what tier you should choose, I do thank you for your support because it really does mean a lot. Have a great rest of your Monday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. Be free.